this morning on Tell Somebody, Homelessness Marathon founder and director and anti-fracking activist Jeremy Alderson released from jail, and a question for the Secretary of Energy, and more.
This is Greg Palast, author of Vulture's Picnic, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, your weapon of mass instruction in the beating heart of America.
Stand by for Tell Somebody. Somebody, September 4th, 2014, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, at Tell Somebody Now, and look for Tell Somebody Now on Facebook. And remember, you can subscribe to the Tell Somebody podcast for free at the iTunes Store. This is your host, Tom Clemmer. If you have any comments or questions about the show, drop me a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. The views and opinions expressed on this show are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the station or anybody else involved with it. The podcast of last week's show about the dedication of the new Kansas City agency-owned, private developer-leased, Honeywell-operated National Nuclear Security Administration National Security Campus has been posted. Look for links at tellsomebody.us, and I'll have just a little bit more audio from the dedication later in the show. Today, this morning, whatever it takes to win $15 and a union. Fast food and retail workers and supporters are coming together again today because no one who works full-time in America should live in poverty. At 11:30 a.m., just over 2 hours from now, at The Grove Park, 1500 Benton in Kansas City, and that's at Truman Road and Benton Boulevard, a couple of blocks east of Prospect, and just south and west of I-70. And I think activities will lead from the Grove Park at 11:30, eventually to downtown by 4:30 this afternoon. More information at www.standupkc.org. So, like I've been saying, if you want to work for change on just about any issue, you really need to be thinking about the Siamese twins of journalism and media reform and overturning Citizens United. Kansas City activists are working hard on one of those issues, at least. on Saturday, September 13th, there will be a benefit for KC Move to Amend, the local chapter of the national organization looking to amend the U.S. Constitution to overturn the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission Supreme Court decision. Groove to Amend will take place 2 to 8 p.m. Saturday, September 13th at the Record Bar, 1020 Westport Road in Kansas City, Missouri. For more information, keep an eye on www.kcmovetoamend.org. Telling the truth in a time of universal deceit. Colleen Rowley is the former FBI agent and whistleblower who was on the cover of Time magazine as Co-Person of the Year in 2002. Colleen Rowley is one of the four who went to Moscow last fall to personally present an award to Edward Snowden. Since 9/11, truth tellers, most recently Edward Snowden, have risked their lives to disclose wrongful conduct. As George Orwell put it, in a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. How and why do social science established groupthink and psychopathy align, especially during times of war, to suppress the truth? 9/11 whistleblower Colleen Rowley speaks on ethical decision-making and intelligence ethics, describing the biggest factors accounting for otherwise good people falling into this banality of evil. Colleen Rowley will be on Tell Somebody next week ahead of her appearance in Kansas City on Sunday, September 14th, to speak at the All Souls Forum. That's 10 a.m. Sunday, September 14th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 4501 Walnut in Kansas City, Missouri. www.allsoulskc.org. In April of last year, I did a segment on the show talking to Jeremy Alderson about a Kansas City company, Energy, since bought by another company, that had plans for fracking in the Finger Lakes of upstate New York. Alderson was one of several people arrested for trespassing in protest of those plans, and you may remember hearing of the arrest and jailing of biologist Sandra Steingraber on Bill Moyer's Journal on PBS and on alternative radio on KKFI. Since that show last year, Alderson has had several court appearances and last Saturday was released after serving a few days in jail for one of his arrests, and I decided to get in touch with him and get an update. Jeremy Alderson is founder and director of the Homelessness Marathon, an annual national radio broadcast that was hosted by KKFI a couple of years ago, and is editor of the No Frack Almanac. Give a listen. Jeremy Alderson, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Last time I had you on the show, you had already been arrested for chaining yourself to a fence or a gate in, I believe it was near Lake Seneca in upstate New York?
Correct.
And you had a couple of colleagues, I guess we'd say, talking with you about plans of a Kansas City-based company to frack in the region around the Finger Lakes in New York. That company has since been bought out by another company, but still the same outfit. And they were going to store explosive gases in unlined, mined-out salt caverns right by the lake. So I guess a lot of time has passed since then, but what's been going on since then?
Well, I
I did actually go to jail on one of the charges, and I have another sentencing coming up next week. I chose to go to jail because I didn't pay my fine. But as for the gas storage project, that is proceeding apace. It's all about whether New York's Department of Environmental Conservation will grant them the permit they need or not. They're spending a lot of money to prepare the site. It used to be Energy. We still, by the way, have an address if anybody's listening, energywhistleblower@yahoo.com, if you haven't done any dirt on Energy. And now it's actually based out of Houston. It's Crestwood Corporation. But we think they would not have put all this money into it if they had not been promised under the table that they would get their way. There doesn't seem to be any democratic process. That's why we're having demonstrations, you know, having civil disobedience, all of this. People of this country don't seem to count for much anymore, and we still feel gravely threatened. The one new wrinkle that really, for me, is that through a long series of things which I won't get into, I wound up working on a single piece of the problem, which I think it turns out maybe to have wide applicability to fights across the nation. I began researching our local fire department to see how well they would actually be prepared if there were an accident at this facility, should it be allowed to open. And it's easy to document that they're not prepared at all. And Crestwood has given them, that they admit to, $15,000. We don't know that that's all it was. But somehow they refuse to say to anybody that they're not prepared. They insist they are, and yet when you get Freedom of Information documents, when you look at the actual data, they're not. So that's kind of scary to feel betrayed by your firefighters.
So this is preparedness for something that might go wrong, storing huge amounts of explosive gases in... Again, I don't understand these things well, but one of the guests when you were on a year or so back talked about these are unlined, mined-out salt caverns holding explosive gases. I mean, what could go wrong, right?
You would think that that might be a kind of common sense thing, but common sense is in short supply these days. You know, we're talking about butane, propane, things like that, and also some fracked natural gas. And they sell this thing as, you know, once the salt is out of the cavern, it forms a kind of hermetically sealed hole. Well, first of all, there's questions about whether the particular salt caverns where we are hermetically sealed. But these very caverns were looked at by the Department of Energy as a place to store nuclear waste, and the Department of Energy decided they were too geologically unstable. And another gas company looked at them as a place to store gas and decided they were too geologically unstable. And by the way, for two different sets of reasons. And now Energy, then Crestwood comes in and, oh, these cameras, they're just fine, and we've got all the data to prove it. And they send that data to the Department of Environmental Conservation and say it's a trade secret. And the Department of Environmental Conservation, being, of course, not on the side of the people, said, oh, yes, that's a trade secret. So they've now made it a trade secret, the geology of our own area, the sonar readings of these caverns, the questions about fault lines. Our own geology is now considered a quote-unquote trade secret, so we don't have to know it, even though it's these very reports that supposedly prove that our lives won't be in danger and we're not allowed to see that.
Well, as Romney said, corporations are people, my friend, and they have privacy rights, I guess. I don't know. It feels like in a different world years ago that should be shocking, and sadly maybe it's not now. One thing that does kind of surprise me a little bit is that area is so heavily dependent on tourism because of the beauty of the lakes and wine country, as I understand, and vacation spot. I guess I'm not surprised that corporate money might influence local and state politics, but I would have thought there'd been a fair amount of moneyed interests that would be very concerned about this and wouldn't want to let it happen.
Well, here we get into a kind of dose of reality, which is that the gas and oil industry is so much bigger than anybody else. It's just like an elephant and a roach, and we are the roaches. In fact, a business coalition of over 200 businesses around here, which are wineries, tourism businesses, hotels, they've all signed on and said we're opposed to this. The legislatures of, I think, three of the counties around here, several of the towns, including where the thing would be, the town of Watkins Glen, have all opposed it. So there's no question about that there's a popular uprising. If even the businesses are involved, they're inherently conservative. But all of that put together just doesn't seem to be the flea on the dog to the power of the gas industry.
Wow. Now, the last time we spoke, New York still had a moratorium or a ban on fracking in place. Is that still in place?
Yes, it is.
But Energy or the subsequent parent company out of Houston still had plans to store gases there even before they started fracking. Is that right? Are they doing that yet?
A little complicated. There is some gas storage on the site that historically goes back actually for a long time. And one of their arguments is that, you know, there's never been a problem, which is not an argument you would take from a drunk driver. I got here at this bar, didn't I?
Right.
But the point is they want to expand it into other caverns now, not the ones that have been stable for a while, thank God. And the ones they want to expand it to are the ones that have been shown to be unstable. So, they want that storage regardless of whether or not fracking comes into New York, because they want to make it the hub for taking fracked gas and other things from Pennsylvania and Ohio. If, however, fracking comes into New York, it will be valuable to them for that as well. And there is a growing feeling here that this is not just another infrastructure project. There's a lot of infrastructure being built in New York State. Pipelines, compressors, they're taking waste from Pennsylvania. There's a lot of stuff going on, which we're opposing, but fracking itself isn't here. I think there's a growing feeling that this fight in Watkins Glen area is the fight. It's not a fight. It's not just another one. They need this facility to make the fracking thing go in New York, but we don't have to have fracking in New York for them to make money off it. It seems to be the way it is.
Yeah. So let's get back to your case again. You served some jail time you were arrested twice, and there's two cases?
That's correct. I did the same thing twice, and so I went to jail for the first one, and my sentencing on the second one is in a few days, and I'm hoping not to go back to jail again. I think the law requires them to let me pay a fine, and I intend to pay the fine this time on the second one. But, you know, I can tell you one thing about jail. You don't want to be there. If you've never been there, don't have any romantic notions about it. It's no fun. It wasn't a great... It's not one of the worst jails that I was in. There weren't rats on the floor and stuff like that, as you might hear about. It just is, it's really a very bad experience. You know, it's nothing to fool around with if you don't have a reason to go. I'll say that much for sure.
How long were you in there?
Just 8 days, which is short compared to a lot of what the other guys were in there for, but it was enough for me.
Are there still protests going on, and are people still getting arrested? I mean, we heard about this besides on this show with you. We heard about it on Bill Moyers about the same time.
Right, and yes, they just had a rally of about 300 people, 2 weeks ago, 10 days ago. So absolutely there are still things going on. Unfortunately, I think our movement is starting to fall apart a little bit. I think there's starting to be tension between, the activists and the moderates. This is the kind of thing that's inevitable in a movement. But, yeah, we still have a movement, and we're making a fight here. And it's both wonderful and awful. I don't know really how to put it. It's inspiring that there are so many people who want to stand up here in this community. But at the same time, we'd all of us, prefer to roll over and go back to bed. It's not like, you know, that's what we wanted to have happen.
Yeah. I've heard parts of some radio shows you've done, talking about this. You want to tell the listeners some links and any other information if they want to support this or hear more about it?
Oh, I'd be delighted. Everything is kind of concentrated right now on one site, which is nofracalmanac.com. NoFrack Almanac is the newspaper I put out, anti-fracking paper and all, and it has stuff about the Stalk cavern storage in each issue, too, and so that's archived there. And I did three, actually, anti-fracking radio show broadcasts on a Binghamton radio station, commercial station, that had Limbaugh and Hannity on it. And I was delighted with that, and those three broadcasts are archived on that site, and so is my report on the Watkins Glen Fire Department archived on that site. So, and I really urge people to look at that because I think there is a collaboration with a lot of local fire departments. I think this is an unspoken issue on a lot of the dangerous things going on around the country. Anyway, again, the website is nofracalmanac, one word, .com.
nofracalmanac.com. And, yeah, I read the, what was it again, Watkins Glen?
Fire Department, yeah. Report on the...
Yeah, I read that report, and that was pretty interesting. I would think that might be a inspirational model for a lot of other fights around the country. What kind of response have you gotten to that? Has it just been blown off?
It's been just blown off, and it's been blown off by even by people who should have been allies. I think that the press has no interest in it. No one wants to touch a fire department. It's really their kind of sacrosanct. It's like, you know, trying to propose, let's have a potluck dinner eating the sacred cow. You know, people don't want to do it. However, and like I said, you read it. I don't think the things that I found there were any joke. I mean, I don't think this was some superficial problem. I think this is a problem that runs fairly deep, and I've been hearing, you know, also that, you know, this fire department or that one has taken money. This seems to be what's going on now. And, you know, I hate to make this particular comparison. I don't want to overdraw it. But if you go back to when the Nazis rose to power in Germany, you can study it and you can see who kind of went for it first. Who failed to stand up to them. And one of the very first, but not the first, places was it was in academia. The universities started having courses on the science of race and stuff like that, which was totally bogus, but they had no backbone. Well, here, it's totally different situation. I don't mean to compare them, but there is this question of who is capitulating the fastest, and it looks like we are really being betrayed by our fire departments all across the country.
And I am all for supporting firefighters.
Me too.
The department politics might be a different thing, but you look at West Texas and the train explosion in, where was it, Quebec or someplace?
Lake Magnetique or whatever they pronounce it as, yeah.
Yeah. Firefighters are at often the most risk when some of these things happen, and there should be some preparedness planning.
You are exactly right in what you say. They themselves pay the price. And really what they should be doing, in our particular case, they haven't even done the minimal. I mean, they don't even have a map of the facility, and part of it's already open. So, I mean, they haven't done anything. It's pathetic. Other departments might be better prepared than that, but the bottom line is it should be the fire departments standing up all across the country saying, what are you doing? You're sending, for instance, you cite the oil trains, which, by the way, they're being sent out by Crestwood. It's the same company that brags that's one of their major businesses is sending out the oil trains. They have no concerns for safety for people that, you know, but let's say they do a lot of unsafe things. You'd think the fire departments all over would be standing in some saying, what are you doing? We're not equipped to deal with this. You're going to be sending these things that are going to blow up in our faces and you're looking at us to deal with it. Don't do it. Instead, you're hearing this kind of huge silence like it's not their problem, and it's mystifying.
Yeah. I have heard some things recently here in Kansas City, which is a major, major rail hub, about just general safety and what goes through this town on rail lines, and I hope there's some more thought and discussion on that.
If anybody is interested in this issue, send a letter or an email to the public records officer of your local fire company and ask them for their emergency preparedness plans and for a list of all the donations they've taken and from who. Not a list, but for a documentation of it. You can ask them anything you want. And they, I don't know what the laws are in your state, so you'd have to find that out, but it doesn't hurt to make a Freedom of Information request and see what you get.
Yeah. Well, you're listening, Kansas City. Jeremy, any final words you want to leave with our listeners on all of this? And repeat your website again.
Well, the website is nofracalmanac.com. That's nofracalmanac.com. And I think that what I want to say is that, you know, there were good things, too, that came from going out of jail and getting in jail and getting out of it. And now my mantra is, it's better than jail. Once you've been in jail, or many people have had much harder times than I have and been in prison and everything, boy, the world looks good.
Okay.
That's all I want to say.
Well, that kind of resonates. Well, Jeremy Alderson, I want to thank you for spending a little time with us again on Tell Somebody, and we'll keep an eye on what ensues in your criminal career in the coming weeks.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Okay.
Again, that was Jeremy Alderson. You're listening to Tell Somebody on KKFI, and we'll be back with a little more audio from the dedication of the new National Security Campus in Kansas City that was featured on the show last week, after you listen to this.
After the Harvest needs volunteers to pick fresh vegetables and fruit in the greater KC area now. All ages are welcome. Please call 816-853-4460 or go to our Facebook page at After the Harvest KC for more information. This message, a public service of 90.1 KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
What if we had more hard-hitting journalism, more local stories, more quality kids' shows, more independent voices?
What if we had more people telling their friends about the vital information they hear on KKFI? What if we had more listeners supporting community radio in Kansas City and the surrounding area? Most of the nearly 2 million people our 100,000-watt transmitter can reach have never heard of us. What if more people helped us get more hard-hitting journalism and more local stories on the air on KKFI? What if more people realized the potential of KKFI and got involved in trying to reach that potential?
What if we had less celebrity fluff, less mind-numbing advertising, less partisan shouting, less junk TV? We need more public media, better public media, new public media, now.
Welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is Tom Clammer. As noted at the top of the show, last week I brought you the audio of the formal dedication of the new Nuclear Security Campus in South Kansas City. And that audio has been posted for you to stream or download at www.tellsomebody.us. And, of course, this new facility replaces the old Kansas City Nuclear Weapons Parts Plant at the Bannister Federal Complex, where numbers of workers have gotten sick or died from exposure to hundreds of toxic materials. After the ceremony, I got the chance to ask a couple of quick questions of Secretary of Energy, Dr. Ernest Moniz, the head of the NNSA, Lieutenant General Frank Klotz, and the NNSA Kansas City Field Office Manager, Mark Holichek.
Very clearly defined. Clearly there are some differences here in the sense that some of the other sites have higher risk operations, but I think this is a great governance example as well for us to propagate. quit doing that anyway. Congressman?
We're looking at ways in which across the entire nuclear security enterprise we can take what's known now as the Kansas City model, both in terms of governance, as the Secretary indicated, but also in ways in which we can develop new facilities to get out of some of the old Cold War facilities that we're in, and taking that forward.
The whole idea of reduced footprints,
yep,
et cetera, we're doing that right now with our uranium and plutonium facilities that we are building elsewhere in the complex.
One of the most important parts of our enterprise, of course, are the people and the experience and talent that they represent. And a quality workforce deserves quality workspaces and quality equipment with which to do the task that we've assigned them to do. So this is an excellent example of how the Department of Energy and NNSA are taking that very, very seriously, and we will try to broadcast that out to other parts of our enterprise as well.
In about 13 months, Honeywell's contract is going to expire here. What factors are you considering in the decision to compete it, and do you have a timeline for making a decision on that?
Well, of course, we're not going to discuss specifics of it, but typically we would try to make a decision, you know, a year in advance. That's coming up. And secondly, obviously, performance is a major consideration. So we will be, Frank and I, in fact, General Potts and I have been discussing that as recently as last night.
No decision yet.
Mr. Secretary, do you have anything to say to people who worked at the Kansas City plant for years and feel that, you know, they got sick from exposure to toxic materials and aren't being taken care of very well by the Department of Energy and business generally, that they're having to jump through a lot of hoops and then not getting a lot of good response?
Well, again, General Klass may want to respond in more detail, but I want to assure you and assure them that I think we have a track record of having taken these issues very, very seriously and doing thorough investigations. I know in my first go-around at Department of Energy, we had a major emphasis on the radiation workers of years past, Portsmouth, Paducah, elsewhere. So on the specifics, I can turn to General Klotz, but we will certainly take any such issues quite seriously.
I would add, obviously, the safety and health of our employees, as well as the surrounding communities, is a top priority, and we devote a lot of time and attention to making sure we get that right. If for some reason we haven't, then we need to let the field office manager here know what if there's specific concerns, and he will in turn let me know, and I'll let the secretary know.
Mark, you want anything? So we have programs in place for former employees, and we invite them to come and participate in those programs and with every opportunity they have. We, of course, our former employees, our current employees, are our number one priority, and we believe that we should take care of them, and we believe we're doing that to the level that we can.
What about the existing plan? I went to the last community advisory panel meeting, and there were questions asked about how CenterPoint could claim to be able to clean up the place for, I believe, it was $175 million. There have been published estimates over the past 10 years or so that it would take, maybe $1 billion to clean it up. There was no response, really, at that CAP meeting to those questions, except the CenterPoint person went on at great length. Government officials, plan officials didn't say a word. People are concerned about, is this going to be cleaned up properly? Any comment on that?
Yeah, so as far as how much it costs for CenterPoint to do the activities they're doing, I would refer you to the CenterPoint. But the one thing we're committed to is to ensuring that the facility gets cleaned up with the standards in place for the facility. We're working with the Missouri Department of Natural Resources and the EPA and the various parties in there to make sure that everything gets done to the level that it needs to get done. And we're committed to that, and I think that commitment has been reinforced both by the Secretary and by the General by all of our leadership today.
Thank you.
Again, that was National Nuclear Security Administration Kansas City Field Office Manager Mark Holacek. I also ran into General Services Administration Regional Administrator Jason Klum.
Okay, I just asked the Secretary if he had anything to say to
a lot of former workers that are concerned they're not being taken care of after getting sick from exposure to hazardous materials. They feel like they're being waited out till they die, or not being responded to, having to jump through a lot of hoops. And also the cleanup of the existing plant. CenterPoint says they can do it for $175 million. There's been published estimates that would indicate something more like $1 billion. And at the last CAP meeting, nobody with the government or with the plant responded to the question. They just left CenterPoint ramble on.
Well, I certainly hope that folks who have concerns about their health do have the information that allows them to pursue claims. There is a process to do that, and I think I and we have continued to encourage folks to pursue legitimate claims through that process. And then I'm hopeful that on the Bannister cleanup, you know, there are advances in technology over time that will allow us to bring about an effective cleanup, you know, at the cost estimates that the private contractor is suggesting. Certainly it's in their best interest to come in on budget because it's their private funds, and those are the estimates that that they presented. I do think that as technology advances at a very rapid pace in terms of the ability to clean up environmental issues, that there is the opportunity, and there has been, to drive down those costs. But you know, we as the federal government are and forever responsible for the environmental issues at the Bannister Federal Complex, and so certainly we'll hold them to the expected standards under the watchful eye of the state and federal regulators.
But can you relate to how seeing no response at a community advisory panel meeting from anybody with the government, why there might be a little chink in the trusting that when they don't respond to a question like that?
Sure. I think it's always better to share what we know. But at this point, you know, the relationship with CenterPoint is kind of developing. And the transfer of the facility hasn't occurred yet. And so I think everyone is trying to figure out exactly where we are and where we're going to be. That's a long way of saying I think those answers will be forthcoming, but I think the relationships have to evolve a little bit more. So a transfer agreement hasn't been entered into. Preliminary site work is only beginning now. And so I think those answers are forthcoming, but I think we just have to get through the process a bit more.
And where you said in your remarks on stage that GSA is still at Bannister, about to move out, where does all that stand?
So GSA will be moving out at the beginning of 15, and then the complex should be vacant at the end of 2015, and we hope for a transfer of the property to the private sector in 2016.
And are you the last out? Everybody will be gone, or is there Marines or anybody still there?
So the Marine Corps will stay at a facility adjacent to the Bannister complex, and then the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is still at the complex until the end of 2015.
GSA's Jason Klum. A few minutes later, I saw Congressman Emanuel Cleaver with an aide and tried to see if he had any comments for sick workers fighting the system.
He's walking up to me. I think he's got one quick question.
Oh, okay.
Is it about today's event? Or
about sick workers.
About what?
Sick workers from the Kansas City plant.
I don't know that he knows anything about that. Let me talk to you and make sure he's prepared. You go to your next thing, and then I'll...
I don't have any information on that. I'm just a dumb mother's preacher. I don't know anything about that stuff.
But you used to work there, and you, as a representative, some of the workers feel like you're not paying enough attention to them on those kind of issues.
Well, I'll find out.
That's not my job.
Right, okay.
Saturday, August 23rd, not quite 2 weeks ago, marked the 25th anniversary of the day when over 1 million Estonians, Latvians, and Lithuanians took hold of each other's hands and formed a continuous human chain stretching for some 600 kilometers from Tallinn, Estonia, through Latvia to Vilnius, Lithuania, demanding the reestablishment of their independence and that the Soviet Union officially recognized the once-secret Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, dividing Eastern Europe into spheres of influence. The Baltic Chain, or Baltic Way as it was called, was held on what was then the 50th, now the 75th anniversary of that pact that led to the Soviet occupation of the Baltic states. I missed the Baltic Way by about a month, but on my first trip to Estonia in September 1989, cousins met us at the Tallinn Harbor after our short voyage from Helsinki, and one of them handed me a metal lapel button with a colorful graphic map of the Baltic states with a line through them showing the location of the Baltic Way. There was a different solidarity and a different history in the Baltics than is the case with Ukraine. In 1989, I met Estonian survivors of World War II-era Soviet mass deportations to Siberia, and through family history, I can understand a little bit why Estonia might want to be in NATO and why they have real concerns about Russia today. President Obama was in Tallinn, Estonia yesterday morning, no doubt as a symbolic show of solidarity with the Baltics and NATO against Russia. He said Estonia will never stand alone. As president, I make sure we're fulfilling that promise. In response to Russia's actions in Ukraine, we'll contribute additional aircraft to Baltic Air Policing Mission. We're continuously rotating aircraft in the Baltics. Well, being of Estonian descent, I hope Estonia will have genuine help and support against any problems that might be inflicted on them by Russia. But is NATO saber-rattling really helpful? The New York Times' David Brooks had one of his typically insipid columns in the Kansas City Star yesterday. His brilliant observation that ISIS and Putin might have broken some of the rules of civilization might be true enough. His implication that the United States doesn't and hasn't is ridiculous. One does not have to outfit Vladimir Putin with a pure white hat or become a member of his fan club to recognize that the current tensions between Russia and the U.S. and Europe over Ukraine, that some fear will spill over into Russia and elsewhere, were largely provoked by Western corporate interests, U.S. and European so-called bailouts of Ukraine by international loan sharks, and the poking and prodding of what I can only call bloodthirsty, lunatic neocons in and out of the U.S. State Department. I would urge you to listen to shows like yesterday's Democracy Now! Segment with former U.S. Ambassador to the Soviet Union Jack Matlock, anything you can find online by Professor Stephen Cohen with The Nation magazine, articles at consortiumnews.com, links at raymcgovern.com, and past editions of Tell Somebody at tellsomebody.us on Ukraine with journalist Robert Perry and former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. I would also direct you to a letter to Germany's Angela Merkel from veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, whose signers include Ray McGovern and next week's guest Colleen Rowley, warning of 2003 shock and awe WMD quality intelligence reports about Russian invasion of Ukraine. U.S. officials are like children playing with matches over a gasoline-soaked Ukraine, and they might start a fire that will be of major concern to a lot more people than just the Estonians and Ukrainians. Speaking of media reform, according to Wikipedia, Condé Nast is a division of Advance Publications and is a mass media company headquartered in the Condé Nast building in New York City that attracts more than 164 million consumers across its 20 print and digital media brands, including The New Yorker. And, apparently, Condé Nast has gotten into bed with Monsanto. The Gawker.com had a piece online August 5th titled, "Here's How Condé Nast and Mo Rocca Are Making Propaganda for Monsanto." The Gawker published leaked internal documents from Condé Nast describing the company's plans for a series of Monsanto-sponsored propaganda videos hosted by Mo Rocca. And the next day, they posted a note from the supposed host, Mo Rocca, saying he had been pitched, but never accepted the offer to be the host, as Condé Nast communications indicated. Then, 3 days later, an August 8th post by Tom Philpott at MotherJones.com was titled, "Read the emails in the hilarious Monsanto / Mo Rocca / Condé Nast meltdown." And this article says that Gawker uncovered a hapless tie-up between genetically modified seed / pesticide giant Monsanto and Condé Nast Media, publisher of The New Yorker, Bon Appetit, GQ, Self, Details, and other magazines, to produce, quote, "an exciting video series on the topics of food, food chains, and sustainability." Philpott also writes that, "Since then I've learned that Condé Nast's Strategic Partnerships Division dangled cash before several high-profile food politics writers in an unsuccessful attempt to convince them to participate." Now, in the wake of all that, I thought it was real interesting to see a piece about Monsanto nemesis Vandana Shiva in the Condé Nast published New Yorker magazine dated August 25th titled "Seeds of Doubt: An Activist's Controversial Crusade Against Genetically Modified Crops." In it, author Michael Spector questions the accuracy of many of Vandana Shiva's assertions about Monsanto and GMOs. And now I'm quite open to seeing a defense from author Spector, but especially after reading Seeds of Truth, a response to The New Yorker on her website, vandanashiva.org, the New Yorker piece looks to me more and more like a deliberately misleading hatchet job on Vandana Shiva in order to make nice with Monsanto for Condé Nast. I thought the New Yorker was better than that. What do you think?
The seed is not separate from its history. The seed is not separate from the soil into which it's planted. It's not separate from the communities with such love and care have evolved it over thousands of years. So, both in the seed and in the quanta, potential to unfold and evolve and not separability. And I think those are universal principles of the way this beautiful world of ours functions.
And you speak about the potential of seeds, and it has always been stunning to me that something like a seed that people have collected and planted for thousands and thousands of years should be subject to patents. And we're here in Kansas City in the same state on the other side from Monsanto, headquartered in St. Louis.
Can you talk about this idea of patenting seeds and your work in relation to this?
Well, in my focus on seed really began in 1987 when I was invited to a meeting on the new biotechnologies. It had a combination of people from the United Nations, people from industry, independent scientists, and I'd just finished my book on the violence of the Green Revolution to understand why Punjab was had become a zone of such violence when the Green Revolution had been given a Nobel Peace Prize. And in fact, I've just been told they're going to put up a statue of Norman Borlaug in Washington for the amazing things he did for the world. But he left a legacy of blood shed. He left a legacy of destroyed water and a cancer train that leaves Punjab. But in the 80s, in 84, Punjab had really become a land of violence. 30,000 people were killed, and I just couldn't put this together with the Nobel Peace Prize. So I said, I've got to study this. I wrote a book, and that got me invited to this meeting. And the industry, you know, at that point had no commercial GMO. In fact, Monsanto was not even a big player at that time. It was still a chemical company related to Agent Orange. The Seabers and the Sandozes were the players. And they said that, A, they said they were too small, these giants. The second thing they said was, we'll be five companies controlling the world's food supply and health, because the same companies are the pharmaceutical industry. And they went on to say, the ones who'll survive as those big five will be the ones who have the largest number of patents in their hand. And the only way to get a patent on seed is through genetic engineering, because you can pretend by putting a new gene into a plant that you've created the plant. And you're the inventor of something living which you cannot invent. Life is not an invention. They also talked about how they needed a global law to protect their patents. And my antennas went up. I just felt this would be a total dictatorship, not just over society, but over life. And I returned to India. The meetings were in Geneva and France, and I returned to India and started to save seeds, just knowing that there was a major threat. Later it came to be that Monsanto actually had written the laws in the WTO called the Intellectual Property Laws. It's called the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights Agreement. And a Monsanto representative in 1995 said, in writing this agreement, we've been the patient, diagnostician, and physician all in one. We defined the problem, and for them the problem was that farmers save seeds. And the solution they created was to define seed as their intellectual property, which is a property in the product of the mind, and therefore any farmer saving seed, at that point, seed that had been patented as engaging in theft, in intellectual property theft. And I found this so wrong that not only did I dedicate myself to saving seeds and reclaiming seed in the commons through community seed banks, I also committed myself to follow Gandhi in saying no to this absurdity of corporations like Monsanto claiming to be the inventors and creators of life. And we have practiced seed satyagraha, which is the force of truth, like Gandhi practiced the salt satyagraha against the British laws that were going to make salt making a British monopoly and were designed to prevent Indians from making salt. Now, the interesting thing is that because around the world there have been such huge movements against GMOs, most people don't realize that the only reason GMOs have been pushed is to collect royalties. And in the final analysis, the royalties come from the farmers. In other businesses, royalties come from competitors. If a company that makes a telephone has a patent, then another company that wants to make a telephone has to pay a royalty for the license. In this case, the royalty is paid by the farmer, and the farmers were the original custodians and givers of all the seeds that are being now patented, with the only addition of a genetically engineered BT gene or a herbicide-tolerant gene. Having seen rejection of GMOs around the world, only 7 countries plant GMOs on any significant scale, the new strategy of these companies is get laws passed to ban local seeds. farmers varieties, heritage varieties, heirloom varieties, and those are the issues we're having to deal with again, where we are saying it is our duty to save and protect diversity on earth, and any law that makes this a crime is a criminal law in and of itself. It should not be obeyed.
Indeed. And am I correct in remembering that there have been some cases of farmers who had non-Monsanto or non-other agribusiness crops that were contaminated by pollen drifting in there from patented plants and having it held up in court that they had to pay royalties even though they didn't plant Monsanto seeds and didn't want to?
The absurdity of claiming patents on GMO seeds and now also non-GM seeds is that it's in the nature of life to reproduce, and it's in the nature of biological reproduction of plants that it's done through pollination. Now, both of these natural traits of seed are being turned on their head by Monsanto laws for patenting. There's a very significant case of the Canadian farmer Percy Smyser, whose fields of canola were contaminated by Monsanto's Roundup Ready canola. And instead of compensating Percy for contaminating his crop, Monsanto sued him for stealing their genes.
Wow.
And tried to fine him $200,000. Percy was tough, as was his wife, Louis. They fought this all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. And the fine was struck down. But the fact that once you allow patenting of genes, then the occurrence of those genes anywhere becomes defined as intellectual property theft. In the United States, thousands of farmers have been sued by Monsanto.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us on KKFI. Comments or questions on the show, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us or a tweet at Tell Somebody Now. And look on Facebook for Tell Somebody Now. Don't touch that dial. Coming right up next is My Place with Larry J. Sprouts comes on at noon, Making Contact at 12:30, Jazz Afternoon with KC at 1. Check out the entire KKFI schedule at www.kkfi.org. And I do hope you'll tune in again at 9 a.m. next Thursday, right after Democracy Now! Check out links to past shows at tellsomebody.us. And if you appreciate the information you get on this show, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth, Facebook, Twitter, email, or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next week on Tell Somebody.